Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm Colin Robertson, your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. On this episode, we speak with Brian Kingston and Michael McAdoo about Canada and the recent U.S.-China trade deal. Brian Kingston is a CGA fellow and vice president, international trade and fiscal issues at the Business Council of Canada. Michael McAdoo is a Montreal-based partner at Boston Consulting Group and co-leads the firm's worldwide trade and investment practices. Some context for listeners. Brian and Michael recently wrote a piece in the Financial Post that Canada is potentially a victim of the recent China-US Phase 1 trade deal. They write, quote, "There is little Ottawa can do in response to managed trade between U.S. and China. The new agreement is certainly not compliant with WTO rules, as the World Trade Organization requires each member country to provide equal treatment to all other members under the, quote, most favored nation principle, unquote. There is also the issue of limited scope. FTAs, free trade agreements, are supposed to cover, quote, substantially all trade. Given the current state of the World Trade Organization and its non-functioning dispute settlement appellate body, challenging the agreement there would be a fool's errand, unquote. So that's context. Well, welcome back, Brian, and welcome, Michael. Michael, let me start with you. Why are we chump change in the US deal?
It really comes down to the throw weight of Canada and international relations. You know, you have a world today that's characterized by three very large economies, being the United States, China, and the European Union. And then the next tier of economies, which includes Canada, still a top 10 economy by that measure, but still substantially smaller. So as these three big trade blocs work out their relations among themselves, taking into consideration the interests of Canada is obviously a secondary consideration.
So in a sense, even though there were efforts by Mr. Trudeau to sort of intervene, particularly around the case of our two Canadians that have been detained, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, we didn't play into this, is what you're saying. Is that correct, Michael?
I think that's right, particularly when things are being done on a more bilateral basis rather than on a more multilateral basis. And I think it comes down to sort of Canada's belief in and requirement for a functioning multilateral system. There's an old quote from Thucydides, "Justice is in question only between equals in power, while the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must." And I think that was as true 3,000 years ago as it is today.
So we're the, as the cities would say, we're the Melians in this one. We have to
exactly
suffer.
That's from the Melian dialogue, exactly.
All right. Well, let me turn to you, Brian. What industries and sectors are going to get hit?
Yeah, so there's a very unique chapter in this trade agreement, in the U.S.-China trade agreement, called expanding trade. And this is not what you would typically find in a standard trade deal. What it effectively does is commits China to purchasing no less than $200 billion U.S. dollars in additional U.S. imports by the end of 2021. And when we saw that, we decided to dig into that purchasing commitment and compare it to Canada's top exports to China. And what we found was that Canada's top 25 exports to China in 2017, 15 of them are covered under this chapter. And that represents about 51% of our total exports to China and $12 billion in value. So very concerning to see that some of our top exports are covered. It means that Chinese importers will be purchasing and switching their supply from Canadian producers to the U.S. And some of the products that are covered there are things like canola seeds, motor vehicles and parts, lumber, soy, coal, lobster, which has been a booming export for Canada over the past few years, as well as pork and aircraft. So a number of Canada's key products and exports are covered by the agreement, and it presents a significant risk to Canadian companies.
So what you're saying is essentially that trade, which we had worked very hard and hadn't got touched by Chinese sanctions like our canola had, but as you point out, we were doing very well on seafood and pork and beef, in part because, well, there had been sanction on it, the Chinese lifted it, in part because they needed it because of the Asian swine flu. But now because of this, in a sense, preferred agreement, which kind of, as you say, violates most favored nation, the Chinese will dine for the Americans and Canadians will lose out. So what are we going to do?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And, you know, what we had seen is in 2018, because the U.S.-China trade dispute, Canadian exports had actually increased to an all-time high. They'd gone up to just about $28 billion. And then in 2019, due to the ongoing Ukraine diplomatic situation and China's ban on Canadian pork for a time and canola, our exports actually fell 16%, which is the biggest decline we've ever seen in 1 year. So we're already starting in a weak position. And then you add in, of course, coronavirus, which is going to have a demand impact in China, and we're in a very difficult situation. To answer your question, what do we do? From a policy and government perspective, unfortunately, not too much. As you noted in your opening, you know, this agreement is definitely not WTO compliant. There's no way. It's too specific. It doesn't cover all trade. And so therefore it does violate what a bilateral trade agreement should look like in the context of the WTO. But we have no ability to go to the WTO and actually challenge the U.S. on this. The appellate body is in disarray. The Americans are considering pulling out of the WTO's government procurement agreement. It is not a functioning place to hash out trade policy disputes, unfortunately. So then the question is, what can business do? And really, the answer is develop contingency plans and do it immediately. I think coronavirus heightens this urgency as well. I mean, demand out of China will not be strong this year. So you can do two things. You can either make sure that you've lowered your prices so that you're competitive with U.S. producers, or you diversify and you find other buyers and you do it as quickly as possible.
Now, you say we can't challenge, and I accept that because of the appellate body and the challenges, although at least the WTO is a talking shop. And I turn to you, Michael, because we're clearly other partners like-minded to Canada. I would think Australia, New Zealand, some of the Europeans would also be affected by the Sino-US trade deal.
I mean, I think that's right. I think if the WTO were functioning, it would maybe be a different calculus. But, you know, given the actual time to get to a dispute resolution and an appellate body result, it would just, even if there were good legal arguments, it would be a very long time, if ever, that you could get to some type of a proper settlement on this. So I think it may be important to do that eventually for the principle of it. But I think in terms of, as companies look at this, they shouldn't count on that as being able to save them from the situation.
So what you and Brian are saying is, don't count on national governments to get you out of this if you're a company. You really got to make your own plans. It's sauve qui peut, as the French would say.
Exactly.
I'm afraid that's right.
Well, your piece, which again, I heartily recommend to listeners in the Financial Times, and there'll be a link in this podcast note, but you raised the whole question of competitiveness. And it leads me to, and I'll ask you, Brian, and I'll let you, Michael, come in. What is the Canadian advantage in a competitive world?
Well, the good news here is that Canada is and will remain for some time an agriculture and a natural resources powerhouse. We've been blessed with these resources. And a lot of the products that we're selling into China, these are in demand around the world. Look at any economy that's developing. They need two things. They need energy and they need food. And we produce that in abundance. So that advantage remains. And we've just done some analysis at the council where we're looking at the opportunity in Africa. As Africa is emerging, you've got a massive middle class, a huge urbanization taking place. And we found that if Canada actually seized the opportunity and took advantage of Africa's growth, our exports to the region could increase by almost $7 billion by 2030. So, you know, there are other markets with huge potential. I'm not suggesting we write off China. That's just simply not possible given their size and scale. But there is a Canadian advantage, and there are other parts of the world where our products are in demand.
So you raised Africa, Brian. We don't have a kind of general trade deal, although the Africans seem to be coming closer to some kind of internal freer trade, although how that's going. In the last few months, we put some attention on it, although it's been more, I think, in relationship to our bid for the UN Security Council seat. But are you saying that we should be looking more closely at Africa as a market?
Absolutely. We're very underrepresented there. I don't think there's a huge role right now for trade policy to lead the way, simply because Africa's got a long way to go. And while they have this new trade agreement, it's going to be a number of years before it reaches a customs union that you could actually negotiate a trade deal with. However, there's a huge opportunity. Not many Canadian businesses are invested there, so we should be taking advantage of it now and starting to get in there with the assistance of government and develop what is our Africa strategy. We were late to the game in Asia. Let's not miss the boat again. and do that in Africa.
Michael, what, you know, you, I'm going to get in a bit to some of your experience, but how do you see Africa?
I think Africa is important, right? And the most important thing is to de-average Africa. You're talking about 54 countries on that continent. You're talking about really diverse regions ranging from, you know, large populous countries with quite large economies, such as Nigeria and Egypt, a smaller country with the most advanced economy on the continent being South Africa. You've got places like Morocco with a very interesting trade strategy, having FTAs with both the EU and the United States. So I would encourage people to look at the market for sure. And as Brian says, you can't take it as a whole anyway. Policy can't take you there, nor can any company. I would encourage folks to de-average that.
So when you say de-average, are you talking about companies, or you mean companies going to deal with like B2B? If you were to pick a couple of countries that you think we should focus on, what would they be?
Well, I think the interesting thing in Africa is if you actually look at growth rates, where you're seeing the highest growth is where you see the best governance in Africa. And at the Boston Consulting Group, we've looked at that, looking at sort of changing rankings in sort of good governance indices and map those back to GDP growth. And what we say in the firm is, you know, governance is the new oil. So places that get their governance model correct and on the right path, places such as Rwanda or Ethiopia or Senegal or Morocco tend to see higher growth rates than places that tend not to get their governance in order. And I think from a foreign investment and even a foreign market entry perspective, this is certainly something that Canadian businesses can take comfort in, because the more places are better governed, the easier it is to make investments in business there.
Yeah, no, I think that's very good advice, again, to people listening. All right, Michael, I want to talk a little bit about as we said just before we began, when you're an executive at Bombardier, and you worked on all sorts of international files, including, as I learned firsthand, the decision to invest in Mexico and Morocco. You were plant manager at the El Marquez site in Querétaro. Tell us a bit about those experiences in terms of Canadian business engaging and working abroad. You were there at the mine face,
indeed.
Or in this case, at the plant face.
Absolutely. I think what was interesting about that was there was a lot of strategic reflection about what our competitor set was at that time. We had seen higher cost aerospace companies in developed markets actually exit the business or even go bankrupt. So, and companies with storied reputations, you know, such as British Aerospace exiting civilian, or Saab or Fokker, or Dornier in Germany. These companies were all, you know, household names at a point in time, certainly in their own regions, and they all exited the business. We also saw the arrival of Embraer from Brazil, new RJ programs in China, Russia, Japan entering the market. And we said, look, we need to be competitive with these folks. So we looked at our value chain of designing and building and selling and servicing an aircraft and said, where do we need to do this to be competitive? And so what we did was we looked at our own operations and said, you know, the design of an aircraft is still something that needs a very high level of engineering talent that we can only get in a place like Canada or the UK. But some of the simpler assembly operations can actually be done more effectively and at a lower cost in other places, in our case, such as Mexico and Morocco. And what was interesting was we were able to get very high level of productivity. We were able to get a very high level of quality and a good level of delivery on time. I'm not saying it was easy, but we actually took the perspective that these would be Bombardier sites in those countries and not, you know, a Moroccan site or a Mexican site within Bombardier. So we came in with the full standards manufacturing processes. We even brought Canadian training curriculums to local colleges to train workers to the same skill level. And we were able to get that. And that actually created space in our Canadian operations, in our UK operations, for more complex pieces of work, such as final assembly of aircraft or the design and manufacture of aircraft wings, which are the most complex component on the aircraft. So the lesson I would take from that is you need to look at your supply chain, your value chain. You know, where are you sourcing? Where are you adding value? Where are you selling? And make sure you've optimized that. Now, the good news for Canada, putting that back at a macro level, is as many businesses become more automated, as there's less and less labor per unit of product, it's actually easier for Canada to be competitive because there's less labor content per unit. Therefore, the labor cost is less important. So we call this the decline of labor arbitrage. And there's actually many, many products which can now be made at the same basic cost, whether that's in a traditionally lower cost market such as China or a higher cost market such as Canada, if you're doing this in a highly mechanized and automated way, it's easy to do, get the same basic cost. I think the second point is the more we move to services and a knowledge economy, a country with the demography of Canada in terms of education levels, in terms of the variety of different skill sets you can have in Canada. And I would also add, in terms of the language skills you have in the Canadian economy, you know, you can serve the world. I had one client who said, you know, gee, I need to have a call center that can do a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week service in English, French, Spanish, and Arabic. And I said, look no further, sir. You should be in Montreal. You have tens of thousands of native speakers of all those languages right on the ground in the city of Montreal. And of course, the person went ahead and did it. So there's certain niches like that that I think Canada can be very competitive in.
Pushing on. Well, I want to go back to Carretero because I visited the plant after you left, and you know, it is very impressive. But I think one of the things you pointed out to us when you spoke to us about the experience there was that, as you point out, the productivity of the workers was as good as what you had. I think if I recall, you were compared it to Japan and Ireland. And the fact that they built this university, in a sense, followed the in this case, it wasn't industry like the Stanford model being built around the university. The university came after the plant had been established, which I thought was quite extraordinary. Are there some lessons there for Canada?
I think there are in terms of how to get productivity up, right? I mean, I think one of the things we suffer from in Canada, and there's been many, many studies on this, is that our productivity growth has been behind that of many, call it competitor countries. And that's a function really of the caliber of your human resources and the level of investment in capital, you know, essentially machinery and other things to automate and make production more efficient. So to the extent that we can get those curricula correct and properly tailored to what industry needs and keep them current, that's a huge positive. And then I think just from a capital investment perspective, there's been a number of fiscal incentives in recent years that I hope will translate into further investment in capital, because that's the other ingredient of productivity.
Now, Brian, we've now got both transatlantic and transpacific, what we think are high-end trade deals, and we should soon ratify the new North American Accord. How do we realize their potential?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, Canada benefits now from having one of the most impressive suite of free trade deals in the world. We're second only to Mexico, I believe, at this point, in terms of the number of countries we have trade agreements with. And we're extremely well-positioned having access to the U.S., now countries such as Japan through the TPP and the European Union with an extremely comprehensive trade agreement. So the framework is there. How do we make sure that businesses take advantage of it? One advantage of what happened with the rise of Donald Trump and all the protectionism that was emanating out of the U.S. was there was a time at the absolute height of the USMCA negotiations where Canadian companies that were surveyed by Export Development Canada were saying that they were seriously taking a look at third markets, diversifying away from the U.S. What's extremely disappointing to me is recent numbers from EDC show that now that we have a trade agreement with the Americans, and as you noted, soon to be ratified in Canada, those intentions to diversify out of North America have actually declined. So we're kind of going back into our old ways. And that worries me. We have everything in place. Our trade commissioner service is now very well funded and excellent. Every member company that I speak to says that, you know, the services are there, the expertise is there. It has now truly come down to a desire for business to take advantage, to understand the opportunities in these deals, and to build customers in new markets.
Now, what about some of the financing arms? Because I know there had been some sense that we also had to make some reforms with both the Canadian Commercial Corporation and the Export Development Corporation. Do you think they've now come, if we got everything in tandem? Because that was one of the questions as well.
Yeah, one of the big issues was that we didn't see a great deal of coordination between the Trade Commissioner Service, the Canadian Commercial Corporation, and Export Development Canada. You would end up kind of getting passed amongst the organizations without having a key point of contact who is coordinating all of the government services. I think that there's been a real effort to try and address that. You know, simple things is even just having a common CRM we didn't have. That will go a long way to making sure that a company is accessing these services through a single window. Where I still see some difficulty, though, is there is a tendency to shy away from providing high-touch special services to Canada's prolific exporters. At the end of the day, our export profile is quite concentrated. Over 60% of our exports are done by a handful of very large Canadian corporations. And there's always a political incentive to focus on SMEs. And I understand that. And I appreciate why you want to help SMEs become exporters and grow. But at the end of the day, we have to help our big players succeed. And that means having a suite of services that are tailored directly to them to help them, everything from financing to market access, you name it. So I think there's still some work to be done on that side.
Particularly with the big, as you say, because there is certainly the tendency and the political imperative is usually to serve the small, as you say, medium size, and we've got lots of there. But it is what brings home the dollars at the end of the day are the big ones. And
exactly. Yeah.
Do they, and that's part of what the BCC serves. Let me tell you, Michael, you've been with a big Canadian company and now you're looking at it, your optic is global. Do you think, at least from a government perspective, Canada's got its act together and the players lined up and coordinating? Are we doing as good a job as, say, other competitors looking at Japan or Germany or others who are also highly trade dependent?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, right? I mean, I think, you can always do better at these things. We're not the only country that has multiple agencies working in the same general space, whether it's inward investment or export promotion or export financing. What I can tell you is, as part of our worldwide practice on trade in BCG, we do serve certain governments who want to improve their trade policy strategy. And as much as we could improve as Canada, I will tell you that ourselves, Mexico, and Singapore are usually the sort of three benchmarks that people tend to gravitate towards. Singapore for the smaller countries, Mexico for a larger country at a lower level of development, and then sort of people look at Canada as a fairly capable country in these areas. That doesn't mean we can't improve. I did spend a couple of years at the BDC, and I think we were working at getting better coordinated with EDC. You mentioned the CCC entity. So I think among those three, there could be a tighter level of coordination. And then, of course, you can add to that the Trade Commissioner Service, which is actually feet on the street in dozens, if not hundreds of cities across the world that could also be, I think, more tightly aligned. So it's not because we're good that we can't become better.
Okay. Well, on that helpful note, I'm now going to turn to what is one of the most popular features of these podcasts. What are you reading these days? And it can be fiction, nonfiction, and Michael in any language. Michael, well, let's start with you. What are you reading?
Hi, yeah, I'm actually reading a book right now by Juan Rulfo, who's a Mexican author who wrote a series of short stories set around the time of the Mexican Civil War. And I'm doing this mostly because I'm actually heading down to Mexico for vacation next week, and I try to read something in Spanish every time I go. So I'm looking forward to getting my mind into a complicated time in Mexican history and reading it in the language in which it was written. I'm very fortunate there's an edition that's published by Folio that has Spanish on one side and French directly on the other. So if I get stuck in Spanish, I can jump over to the French and get myself out of the stuckness.
So it's not only fun, but educational as well. Well, good for you and enjoy that holiday. Brian, what are you reading?
I'm currently reading a book called Loon Shoots by Safi Bakal. It's a fascinating read around how group behavior can change dynamics around new ideas and innovation. It looks at things, for example, where I'm reading a section right now about how there was a breakthrough in World War II to design radar, which obviously was fundamentally transformative for the Allies in the war. Yet the people who were thinking about how to do this were being kind of crushed by the bureaucracy of the U.S. Defense Department. So it looked at examples of organizational or behavior and how you design and structure in a way that helps people innovate and come up with new ideas.
And I'm going to strongly recommend, which I just finished, Peter Singer's Like War, which is about the weaponization of social media, Twitter and things. And he takes you through from Gutenberg and the printed press to the Telegraph and then going forward. It is, I think, a required reading for something that we all have to deal with today. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Brian Kingston and Michael McAdoo. Remember, you can find the CJAI Network on iTunes and Google Play. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating on whatever you're listening through. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And there you will find links to the paper that both Brian and Michael wrote and some of the other references they've made. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I am Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.